Now, we're going to have a short panel discussion on the whole issue of Brexit. It's been a very interesting week, of course, as far as the negotiations are concerned. We have had the Irish Foreign Minister, who has told us that the divorce period is going to have to be more than 5 years. I've heard of sham weddings, but this is a sham divorce he's proposing. I've known people who've been married two or three times in 5 years, let alone divorce. We have had the controversy, of course, with Lord Kilcluny and the Irish Taoiseach. I know we're not allowed to call him an Indian, but there's a pair of them, as far as the people in Lorne are concerned, Coveney and Varadkar, are a pair of cowboys. So we're going to discuss that. And of course, the Prime Minister's cough has returned to her this week. She's been coughing up another lot of billions for the EU, and we will maybe have some comment on that as well. So there's quite a lot to discuss this morning, and we've got our panellists, David Simpson, who is our economy spokesman in Westminster. Michelle, who took over from the other Michelle when she moved to become Gerry Adams' puppet. And then Diane Dodge. I heard Diane described last night as a lovely young lady. Now, had that been Westminster, the person involved would have been in front of the whip, suspended, and on the front page of the Sun this morning. But it was a compliment to Diane. It was a genuine compliment being paid. So we've got a number of questions, and I don't think we're going to get through them all. Diane's just had a time to speak, so I'm going to give you a wee bit of a break for a moment or two, and I'm going to move first of all to Michelle. Michelle obviously had a very important role as the Agriculture Minister in preparing the position papers for Northern Ireland and making representations to the government on agricultural issues. And I suppose what concerns a lot of people, because agriculture is so important, Michelle, is what is going to happen to agriculture post-Brexit? We've had a long period with CAP, with some of the benefits of it and many of the faults of it. And I suppose what I'd like to know from you, what direction of travel do you see the mechanisms which have been set up for to deal with agriculture after Brexit?
Well, I suppose really at that time, we could, at the time of the vote, we could actually see the benefits of having devolution and having devolved ministers in place. And certainly I was able to react very quickly, because the following Monday we were able to establish the Brexit Consultative Group, which essentially brought people from right across the agri-food sector and also the environment sector together with one purpose, and that was for us to hear firsthand the challenges that they were being presented with at that particular time, and also the opportunities which could be explored. And also it was to provide Northern Ireland really with one strong voice and a clear message from that. During that period of time, obviously, I was able to build up good working relationships with the then Secretary of State, Andrea Leadsom, and also with George Eustace. And I know that colleagues are working very closely now with Michael Gove, and I've met with him several times as well. So we were able to facilitate, and certainly I was able to facilitate meetings for those people to come to Northern Ireland to really understand the unique situation that we do have here and the dependence that we have on agri-food and within our rural communities. Now, unfortunately, my tenure was cut very short. And on the last day of office in March, I was able then to write to Andrea Leadsom really to set out what I considered, and certainly the sectors considered, to be the key issues for us. And moving forward, it is about presenting ourselves with a situation where we have sustainable, profitable, productive agriculture moving forward, and about putting in place the mechanisms to allow for that to happen, and ensuring that, you know, there are measures against sort of volatility in the markets and so on as well. But very importantly, it's in relation to our borders and ensuring that there are no borders between ourselves and the rest of the United Kingdom. But there is a vacuum there, and we do have the devolved agriculture ministers who are meeting, and we don't have that strong, passionate voice for the farmers and the fishermen from Northern Ireland present. But I'm confident that colleagues are representing us as we're moving through the processes.
One of the things, and this has comes through all the time at Westminster, especially from the Scots and the Welsh, who may simply be scoring political points, but how do you feel the relationship between the devolved administration and the government has been in making sure that the views of regional administrations are heard and are being listened to by ministers at Westminster?
Well, I mean, particularly at that time, it was vitally important for me, and I could actually see the benefit of those meetings, particularly from being a Brexiteer and coming from that perspective. I felt that it was useful, particularly whenever you were speaking to the Secretary of State. And at the same time, you were able to understand the broader issues and the challenges, and also the similarities that we have and we share, actually, with our Scottish neighbours and with the Welsh. So that was important. And that absence of someone around that table is something which is very critical.
Okay. David, let me go and just staying on the same agricultural issues for a moment. We don't want to dominate it with agricultural issues, but it is such an important one. You're a member of the EFRA committee in Westminster. How is the party using our influence on that committee in terms of the Brexit timetable, the new British Agricultural Bill, which is going to be very important because it's going to replace CAP, and how do you think that's going to... What can we do to ensure, and what proposals are being put forward to ensure that, first of all, farming remains sustainable and also that animal welfare issues are addressed? That's been a big issue this week, of course, about with all this nonsense about sentient stuff.
Thanks, Tommy. This year round, I'm the only Northern Ireland representative on the DEFRA committee. Margaret Ritchie, as you know, was on that and she didn't get her seat again, so I represent Northern Ireland on that. And the agriculture bill itself is due, I think, May-June of next year. But we're working towards that at the minute. We're taking evidence from a number of companies in Northern Ireland, the processors, Ulster Farmers Union, with a delegation last week, which seven of our MPs met, I think it was on Tuesday, just passed. So we're listening to what the organisations are telling us. And I think that's important that we do that. As regards your influence on the whole of the bill, I mean, to be fair, Neil Parish, who is the chair of the committee, has given me time with him and with others within DEFRA to put the policies forward for Northern Ireland to ensure, as Michelle has said, sustainable farming after we come out of this. Because we need sustainable farming that, in the sense that the farmers get a return for their produce, the processors, and then the retailers, the three need to work together. And I think if we can achieve that, we will have achieved something for farming. The animal welfare is something that is a very sensitive issue. Gove, the Secretary of State, has said that he will ensure that he will limit, if not do away with, live animal exports and all of that, which in itself is a difficulty, I have to say, for the agri-food sector. It's not a very popular thing to say, but at times animals do have to be exported in order to keep the price of structure right for farmers and for others within the industry. So I think it's very sensitive, but it's something that we're working at. But I have to say that from the last election, our 10 MPs, I think we have 8 MPs on select committees, so the government's listening to what we're saying. The Prime Minister, on two occasions in Prime Minister's questions, when I put the question to her about the future of agriculture in Northern Ireland, she has said, in fact, it was three times, that Northern Ireland agriculture will not be the poor cousin to any negotiations when it comes to Brexit. So we're holding our feet to the fire on that one.
Okay, and maybe just to elaborate on that, David, the key asks that you'll be looking for specifically for Northern Ireland agriculture. And also, and this has been a big issue, as you'll know, in the House of Commons, where the powers are taken back, first of all, by the UK government. And the Scots and the Welsh are saying they should be immediately devolved to Scotland and to Wales. The government is saying we need to keep a common UK market. How do you see that playing out? At what stage, then, should the government be saying, And what kind of powers would you see the government saying should be devolved back to the local administration? Michelle, you might want to comment on this as well. And what powers should be retained to ensure that there's a common UK market?
Well, I think that last point is vital, Sammy, that we do have that common approach, because there are those who are trying to influence that Northern Ireland is taken out of the UK agricultural side. And we've got to ensure that doesn't happen. I believe that, you know, the key asks that we have put forward in the DEFRA committee and listening from the processors is the whole issue about the free movement of people, the free movement of goods and services across the border. How will it be affected when we come out of the European Union as regards the market itself right across the whole of the European Union? And we keep getting messages back, Sammy, where, you know, this is going to take a long time and this is going to be going over a 5-6, maybe even a 10-year period. But if anybody is being real about this whole subject, if they're telling us that the remainder countries within the European Union do not want to export to the sixth largest economy in Northern Ireland, there's something wrong with their head, because they're screaming to get doing business. It's the Europeans, European Brussels, and Diane would know more about this than I, are trying to hold things back, and we've listened to what the Southern Government has said. But there are a number of issues there that we need to maintain for the agriculture per se going forward, and we need a better partnership within that agricultural system between farmers, processors, and of course the retailers. It's all a partnership, and I think we can achieve it. And we're getting access to not only Gove, to the Farm Minister and to others. Diane and myself and a few others are meeting with the Farm Minister, I think it's the 6th of December, a number of issues that are coming up there as well. So agriculture is to the fore, and I can assure you, as Diane said in her speech, we will not be letting the Northern Ireland farmers down when it comes to any deal in any shape or form for the future of agriculture.
Yeah, just in relation to the UK framework, it's important that we do have a common policy that right across the United Kingdom. But mindful of the fact that we do require an element of flexibility, but I think we still have to be mindful of what that is, because we don't want to set ourselves up that we then become competitors with Scotland and Wales as well, so then that becomes an issue for us in the longer term. So we still have to be careful. But there will be issues that we will be wanting to look at, particularly around this issue where farmers are working to dates and so on, which becomes absolutely ludicrous whenever you take into consideration
such as the nitrates directive and that kind of thing.
Weather conditions and so on as well, particularly around slurry. But there are other issues as well we need to look at, and there are flexibilities which would be required around that.
Diane, you're obviously seeing the picture from the European Parliament end. What's your assessment of the negotiations so far?
Well, as we all know, these negotiations were sequenced really by Brussels. We have three main priorities in the first phase of the negotiations. That is citizens' rights, the rights of EU citizens living in the United Kingdom, and the rights of United Kingdom citizens living in the rest of the European Union. I am told that there are still some issues to address around that, particularly issues about who guarantees those rights. And, of course, the European Union would love to have a role for the European Court of Justice in that, but we are very, very firm that the European Court of Justice should have no extraterritorial rights, and that in a post-Brexit United Kingdom, we will not be subject to the European Court of Justice. So there are still... smaller issues, but very significant issues to address in that one. The second issue is the money. And trust me, everything in Brussels is about the money. I had a briefing from the Budget Commissioner recently, and he said that the gap in funding every year in Brussels in a post-Brexit world will be 25 billion. That's the net contribution of the United Kingdom, plus the amount that it will cost for all the new priorities that the European Union want to do. Of course, they want a new common and defence policy. They want further integration, more federalism. So I can only see one way for our European neighbours after the United Kingdom leaves, after we cease contributing to the European Union, and that, of course, is for member states to up their contribution or for the European Union to impose some kind of direct taxation model, and they're already talking about that. So in Dublin, where we have all kinds of creative taxation models, I think they'll be very, very aware of that one. The issue of Northern Ireland remains thorny and very much on the agenda. We are absolutely committed in this party to ensuring that there will be no border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. We will enjoy the benefits of the United Kingdom single market just as every other part of the United Kingdom will. And we will not be separated from our main market. I say often that this would be politically unthinkable and economically catastrophic for Northern Ireland. December Council meeting, the second week in December, is the key date in our diary. Where the European heads of state will meet, and they will decide on a recommendation from Michel Barnier, the main negotiator, whether there has been enough progress to move on. I think that's still in the balance.
You mentioned about not being cut off from our main market, and it may be worthwhile just rehearsing the arguments, Diane. Why is... Because, you know, we hear so often... we're going to get cut off from the EU market, and that's why you have to stay in the single market and the customs union. Why is the UK market so important to Northern Ireland?
Northern Ireland sells more of what it produces, rears, etc., etc. It sells more in the GB market than it does in the Republic of Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in the rest of the European Union and the rest of the world put together. The absolutely key market for us is the GB market. It would be economically catastrophic for us to arrive at some kind of contrived situation forced on us, I may say, by the Republic of Ireland or the rest of the EU, and that we would cut ourselves off from that important market.
We can't have the best of both worlds. Kenneth Clark was on The View there the other week, and he was saying, Northern Ireland can have the best of both worlds. Stay in the customs union, stay in the single market, and still be part of the United Kingdom. Is that possible?
Well, I think that Kenneth Clark obviously is an ardent pro-European, and he would, of course, say these things. Just look at who is really pushing this agenda. The rest of the European Union and the Republic of Ireland. Why are they pushing it? Because for them, access to the GB market is very, very important and very valuable. Northern Ireland can never constitutionally separate itself from the rest of the United Kingdom, and economically it would be in grave danger should it even contrive to do so. Just recently we had a situation with Catalonia and Spain, and our Gibraltarians will understand this, where the EU said that no, we cannot interfere in the issue of Catalonia because it's an internal matter for the Kingdom of Spain. Well, Northern Ireland is an internal matter for the United Kingdom, and we will not allow Brussels to interfere.
We're probably running out of time, but an issue which I think does need to be addressed because it's been raised so many times, and Diane, you've kind of half mentioned it in one of the answers that you gave, is the whole issue of people who are currently in Northern Ireland, who are working in Northern Ireland, who have settled in Northern Ireland, and also the needs of the some industries in regard to labour, which is immigrant labour. Michelle, it's been said that, look, we need to control our own borders. But does controlling our own borders mean that we can't use labour from outside Northern Ireland?
No, absolutely not. And Diane made that very clear in her speech whenever she said, really, that we're moving from a system which is rights-based to needs-based. And we've heard that from many sectors that we've spoken to over the last number of months, particularly around agri-food and even last night, hospitality, Ulster, referred to it as well. And the needs that, the need that we do have for skilled and also soft-skilled people to fill gaps. Now, but taking that into consideration, we still need to look at the skills and the needs of those local citizens. And that's really incumbent on us within our colleges and our schools to ensure, and as three former teachers on this panel, we recognise the need for skills. And it's about speaking directly to those industries to see what they need and to create bespoke courses and also apprenticeships where necessary in order to upskill and to reskill to many of our local people as well.
Okay. And maybe, David, I should just take that question a wee bit further. Michelle has outlined why we need to have it. How do we ensure the supply of labour, which may well, for the foreseeable future, have to come from outside the United Kingdom?
Well, there are a number of points. I mean, I think the skill-based one is important, that our colleges work with industry to create the courses that are needed for that. That partnership has started to happen, so we're seeing a lot of changes. We need to encourage our young people into the apprenticeships, and we need to have the proper apprenticeship schemes to fit that. I think with going forward, I think we need that work base coming in from Europe. We have some of our factories in Northern Ireland are 60% dependent on people coming from other countries, and we need to ensure that. But I think it was David Davies that said recently, he said, yes, we are going to reduce the number of people coming in from other countries, but we've got to be realistic that it's going to take years, if ever, we get to the stage that we have our young people, our Indigenous young people, trained to go in to those industries. And it has to be said, ladies and gentlemen, that not all our young people want to work in the food sector. I mean, it is sometimes cold, it is difficult for them, and they don't want to do that.
So, David, if that's the case, and we are then going to be partially reliant anyway on labour from outside the United Kingdom, what kind of immigration policy do you see being used to ensure that you don't swamp the labour market,
absolutely,
but at the same time you do have the labour that you need?
Well, I think the government have put out a policy that if people are here over 5 years or whatever, they'll get permanent residency. But I think that needs to be controlled through the industry itself and with agencies that bring people in, whether it be on a full-time basis or whether it be on seasonal. Seasonal is a major, major issue for the horticultural industry as well. I mean, it's got to the stage now this year that because of currency, because of the uncertainty of a number of things, I think it's the people coming in to work in the whole of the United Kingdom's down something like 17%. That's a massive reduction. And we need to ensure that. So I think we need to control it. The agencies, whether it be in temporary visas or whatever the case, or work permits, whatever needs to be done, I think it can be done. And the system can be put in place to do that. But we need to get it right so that our industry doesn't suffer, so that in years to come, hopefully, we will have enough people from Indigenous people to do the work. But that is a big challenge.
Okay. And just one last question, because I think our time's nearly run out. But almost every day now, we hear on the radio discussions, I'm sick and tired of hearing it at Westminster, including from the Unionist MP for North Down, that Brexit is going to put the peace process in jeopardy. And of course, Brussels have now taken up this song. I think, Diane, you made the comment at a meeting I was at recently that they've all now become experts in the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, is this overreach by Brussels, and is it simply scaremongering by the opponents of Brexit?
I have been in Brussels now for quite a number of years. I have never heard in Parliament or in the other institutions as many supposed experts on the Belfast Agreement. I think that Brussels should remember one of the key cornerstones of policy in Brussels is the issue of subsidiarity, so that you should not tread on issues that are the prerogative and the sole prerogative of the member states. Neither should you interfere in the constitutional issues of those member states. And what Michel Barnier actually said 2 weeks ago when he released the paper advocating that Northern Ireland should either stay in the customs union and the single market or follow the rules of the customs union and single market was actually to interfere in the internal affairs of the United Kingdom. Now, what I would say to the European Commission and to the European negotiating teams, our Prime Minister has said very, very clearly at the dispatch box in the House of Commons on a number of occasions, there will be no internal borders within the United Kingdom. And how the United Kingdom organises itself in a post-Brexit United Kingdom is up to the United Kingdom. It is not up to Brussels. And therefore, we need to be firm in our negotiating stand. We need to work alongside the government to make sure that the issues are understood, and we must not allow Brussels to overreach its remit into our constitutional affairs.
Thanks very much to all of the panel. Could I just do a wee plug? I'm not getting any financial gain from this at all, folks. But for people who are interested in all of the arguments around this, because we hear so much biased propaganda from the media on this issue. Yeah. I mean, there's a tsunami of propaganda trying to rewrite the result of the referendum. There's an excellent book has been written by Liam Hannigan, who used to write for the Financial Times, and Gerard Lyons, called Clean Brexit. Fantastic book for anybody who's interested in looking at the in-depth, the arguments, facts, plenty of statistics, plenty of ideas about how negotiations should be carried on. A good wee book to read, and it'll not put you to sleep at night either. It'll be a one for keeping you awake through the night, if you don't want to go to sleep. Very, very useful. And I think it is important, as a party which stood to break the shackles of the EU, that we know the arguments that need to be made, and we make them forcibly, and we have a good team doing that at Westminster, at Brussels, and also here in Northern Ireland. Thank you.